Last spring, the legislature passed a wide-ranging overhaul of the state's criminal justice system, SB 91. Political opponents say the law is bad for public safety. Supporters argue it's based on laws that are reducing recidivism around the nation. I'm Ann Hillman. On today's Talk of Alaska, we'll discuss what this massive bill actually does, who it impacts, and what parts are already in place.
Today's program is underwritten in part by
First National Bank Alaska. For nearly a century, First National has been Alaska's community bank. Learn how experience and local knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com.
And by
ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. It's a fact. 85% of Alaska Native and American Indian people don't use illegal drugs. For more resources on building a healthy life, visit anthc.org/weare. This message sponsored by ANTHC, a nonprofit organization. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Senate Bill 91 is a bipartisan omnibus crime bill. It does things like reduce sentencing lengths, expand victim notifications, and reinvest savings into programs such as addiction treatment. The bill is 123 pages long, and people are still working to fully understand it. I have two guests today who will help us do just that. Deputy Public Defender Tracy Wallenberg, thank you for being here, and the Director of Criminal Division at the Department of Law, John Skidmore.
Good morning.
Thanks. Do you have any questions about SB 91? Want to know how it could impact you or your community? Let us know by calling 1-800-478-TALK or 550-8422. You can also email us at talk@alaskapublic.org. So again, thank you both very much for being here. Before we jump in, Tracy, can you talk a little bit about what just the overall goal of this bill?
Sure, I'd be happy to. And thank you for having me this morning. Senate Bill 91 grew out of the Criminal Justice Commission process. In 2014, the legislature established the Alaska Criminal Justice Commission, which was, or is, a 13-member interbranch commission tasked with evaluating the sentencing laws and criminal justice practices in Alaska and making recommendations for improvements. And in 2015, the three branches of the Alaska government requested technical assistance from the Pew Charitable Trusts and tasked the commission specifically with developing recommendations aimed at safely controlling the prison population and recalibrating our correctional investments to ensure we were achieving the best public safety return on our state dollars.
Why? Is there a problem? Like, too many people, recidivism was too high, prison population was growing, what was...
So in the 10 years between 2005 and 2014 in particular, and that's really the decade that the commission was looking at, incarceration grew significantly in the state. It grew 27%, which is three times faster than the resident population. And this was across all facets, pretrial, post-conviction admissions, and admissions for technical violations on probation, and even increased supervision on probation and parole. And despite this increased in correctional spending, and the corrections budget increased significantly during those 10 years, and despite this increase in correctional spending, two out of three inmates were returning to prison within 3 years of their release. And so the system that we had in place and the practices that we were using were increasing incarceration without any significant impact on recidivism. And so this whole process was an attempt to rethink the way we approach the criminal justice system and the way we invest our correction spending in order to improve public safety and hopefully get better outcomes for everyone across the board.
Okay. And so the legislature discussed this bill for a good number of years, right?
No. The legislature discussed SB 91 for one session. And while I agree with everything that Tracy just said about how SB 91 came to be and what the commission was focused at, one of the unfortunate things that happened is it didn't take into consideration what was happening with crime rates. Historically, in the United States and in Alaska, the crime rate has gone down since 1996. It wasn't until 2015 that we start to saw it tick up again slightly. And so one of the difficult balances that has to be found with any criminal justice reform is, how do you reduce recidivism? Because Tracy's comments were all accurate. Recidivism was a problem, remains a problem, and folks are trying to figure out how to reduce recidivism. But the fact that you reduce recidivism does not automatically mean that you also reduce the crime rate. That's the theory and the hope, but that's something that we'll have to see whether or not it occurs.
Okay, so let's pause for a second here. You said the crime rates were going down. There was less crime for like 9 years, and yet prison...
No, for 20 years.
Oh, geez. Welcome to me in math. So for 20 years, crime rates are going down.
Yes.
And yet prison populations were still growing.
Correct.
I explain that. I mean, is there a correlation? Like, what?
When you start to talk about correlations, I think it's really difficult when you get into those areas. What we know is that both in the United States as a nation and as well as in the state of Alaska, we saw many legislatures and many politicians that had these notions of, we're going to get tough on crime, we're going to increase sentences, we're going to put people in jail, we're going to lock them up. That comes with a cost. The strategy that was laid out to reduce the crime rate through that getting tough on crime was actually working because it was reducing crime, but the problem was the amount of money that it cost, and those that were going into prison came back out of prison, as almost all of them do, and they were more likely to commit crimes again in the future. And so the question that's really posed, and I think what the commission was struggling with, is there a way for us to maintain the public safety that we've been able to achieve and reduce the recidivism rate as well? Because if you can do both of those things, now you're really cooking with gas. And I think that's what they're attempting to do.
Okay. Do we know, like, has data proven that crime rates went down because of all of these tough on crime laws? Like,
no.
So you can't say that all of these laws that increased sentencing, increased sentences for minor offenses, you can't say that that actually led to the decrease in crime.
There's a theory that suggests that that may be what happened, but I don't think there are any studies that definitively show that. I think what's difficult when you look at criminal justice is there are all sorts of factors that can impact what's going on, what's happening in budgets for law enforcement, for prosecutors, for defense attorneys, what's happening in society as a whole. Do you have drug epidemics? Do you have other things that are happening, economic factors, for instance? If you have a downturn in the economy, you can say that when people are struggling more, that sometimes you can see an uptick in property crimes or in thefts. So there's any number of factors that can play into it. And to say that there is one cause or one thing that's made it work, I think is very difficult to say that.
I think another important thing to remember about this process is it really was an attempt to rethink how we approach criminal justice. And what the commission found is that something like 95% of people who go into prison are going to return to the community at some point, right? And we have to think about, you want to provide them supervision and treatment that's going to be most likely to change their behavior. And in order to achieve savings that you can reinvest in the treatment and the supervision that's needed for people as they transition back into the community, the state needed to rethink how we approach criminal justice. And so the whole focus of this process the processes, similar processes you've seen in other states who have gone through criminal justice reform, is to try to focus prison beds primarily on the most serious and the most violent offenders, and by doing so, achieve savings and reinvest those in treatment and supervision and other programs that are attempt to rehabilitate offenders.
Okay.
I would agree with Tracy that I think what they're trying to do, the policymakers, the folks in the commission, is they were saying there's an awful lot of individuals that suffer from mental health issues or that suffer from some sort of substance abuse, and simply putting those people in prison was not an effective way of trying to address the behavioral problems that they had that caused them to commit those crimes to begin with. And so at the heart and soul, and the part that the Department of Law was absolutely supportive of then and remains, is we've got to try and find a different way of addressing those behavioral problems for those two sets of members of our population. And if we can do that, then I think will be essentially what they try to describe as smart justice.
And indeed, there have been encouraging results that have come out of other states from similar processes. And one of the really interesting, just building off what John said, one of the interesting pieces of research that the commission relied on in making its recommendations was a growing body of research that showed that for many individuals, prison is not more effective at reducing recidivism. And in fact, for people who commit low-level offenses, prison may actually increase recidivism as it interferes with, you know, pro-social aspects of their life, their jobs, their housing, their families.
I agree with what you're saying, Tracy, but I want to make sure that we're clarifying. It didn't actually say it was low-level offenses. What the research did and what the commission looked at is that there were different classifications of individuals. So you have someone who's a high-risk individual versus someone who's a low-risk individual.
And how do you make that determination that someone is high versus low-risk?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So this is one of the things they're attempting to look at right now in the new pretrial services unit that they're trying to put together. And there are questions that you essentially ask either the individual or you look at information from their history to decide, is this someone that is more likely to recidivate, or is this someone who is more likely to comply with court orders and therefore not be a problem? And that's, you're looking at that pretrial. There are similar concepts for those folks that have to be sentenced. And the idea is we want to try and separate those folks who, with a little bit of correction, whether it's a fine or community work service or some sort of probation or supervised probation or treatment, are there those folks that we can do that sort of corrective action for, and therefore they won't commit crimes in the future? Those are the folks we don't really want to be putting in jail, because if we do, the studies suggest that they're more likely to continue to commit crimes. However, what the research also indicates is that there's a segment of the population that trying to do those sorts of things doesn't decrease their likelihood of committing crimes. It will actually increase their likelihood of committing crimes. There is a small segment of the population, therefore, that when they've committed crimes, if we properly identify them, are the ones that we should be sending to jail and being more aggressive with. The trick is trying to separate those two.
And how does one do that?
Those are the really difficult questions that I think the commission and I think folks in the criminal justice system all across the country are struggling to sort those things out. And there are different ideas. One of the ideas is the risk assessment tool that the pretrial services unit is attempting to develop right now. They've looked at other states, places like Kentucky, that have used a tool that was very effective. And what that tool looks at is it looks at the person's previous criminal history and other factors that help them sort of say, this is most likely where this person will fall. It's not predictive in the sense that it's going to say, you will not commit a crime. It just says, these objective criteria mean that you are less likely to commit a crime than someone that has different objective criteria.
So what would the objective criteria include?
Well, they include things like individual's failure to appear in court, the previous criminal history, what that criminal history consisted of, how had they performed on probation. There are different factors like that, and each state approaches it slightly differently. And the reason they approach it slightly differently is because each state will have different systems or mechanisms for collecting data from the criminal justice system. And you have to be able to go back and look in that database, that data that's provided, and you have to say, from the data that you have, what is the predictive aspects of that data? From the information or the resources you have available to you, which of that information is going to be the most helpful? And then that's the information that you would build into the risk assessment model, is essentially the way it works.
So some risk assessment tools build in things like income. They build in things, no?
No, income's not one of them that has been found in any state that I'm aware of to date that is in any way predictive of someone's potential for committing crime.
Great.
And my understanding of the risk assessment tool is that it will be based on these objective criteria, and the efficacy of it will be tested before it's rolled out. It'll be validated based on the Alaska-specific pretrial population, and it'll be monitored once it is implemented to make sure that it's working effectively, as will all the reforms in SB 91.
So there'll be a big focus on making sure that there's not any built-in biases.
Correct.
Absolutely. That's one of the things that they've been focused on, is trying to collect the data to test it, just as Tracy has said, and then also what are the steps that will be in existence in the future to make sure that if it's predictive, that it's predictive across the entire population evenly and doesn't say disproportionately affect one segment of the population based on race or ethnicity or gender or anything else that would be inappropriate.
Okay. Just because I remember back in the spring, ProPublica did a big study looking at, I think, a system out of Michigan, and it showed that there was a lot of racial bias within the system. People with similar situations, African-Americans, were more likely to be imprisoned. And so clearly you're both nodding and you're aware of these issues. And so those will be factored in developing these systems for Alaska.
Those are certainly things that I think any professional in the criminal justice system tries to remain attuned to. It's work that the Criminal Justice Commission is interested in. The Alaska Judicial Council does studies that looks at those sorts of things and tries to point out, are there disparities in the way in which individuals in our state are treated by the system in terms of the sentences they get for similar types of crimes. So that's absolutely something that's important to everyone.
The monitoring component is critical, right, to make sure that the type of thing that you're talking about in terms of disparities doesn't present itself, and if it does, it's addressed by the commission and the legislature.
Because in Alaska, there's already a disproportionately high number of Alaska Natives in the correction system.
That's correct.
Correct.
And so will some of the things within SB 91 be trying to address that at all?
I don't know that anything in SB 91 was designed to specifically address that particular issue, but anytime you make changes that are as significant as those made in SB 91 for a system as large as the criminal justice system, then you're absolutely going to be monitoring that to see what happens. Did you achieve the desired results? Were there unintended consequences that were either positive or were negative? Those are all the sorts of things you want to look at. And I think everyone is hopeful that in making these sorts of changes, that it will help all sorts of issues.
And we have a caller on the line, Ty from Anchorage. Welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Hey, thank you. And first off, thank you for having this discussion and actually opening up the curtains and looking at the mess that we have and trying to do better. A couple of things on the assessment tool that I thought were important to include were the fact that, you know, to rehab somebody, they have to be habilitated to begin with. And so the assessment tool also includes things like educational level, work history, and relationships, whether you have maintained or developed and maintained long-term primary relationships. These are all part of the assessment.
Wait, how do you are you working with this assessment tool, or have you, it's still under development.
No. There are assessment tools across the board, many of them, mm-hmm. and so this is not a new concept by any stretch. They use it with sex offenders. They get an assessment, and so all of this is already in place. We just know that the system is draconian. We see it all the way through on race. It's even gender bias, and people with money are less affected. They can afford better defense. People without money don't really get an adequate defense, and on and on and on. And lastly, here's my last point, and I'll hop off and listen. And again, thanks for doing this, is that when they write the probation requirements to an individual, and they put that on there, that it is such a long list of things. A person who's charged with a crime that had nothing to do with alcohol now has an alcohol restriction and can be violated and sent back to jail for having a legal beer when their crime had nothing to do with alcohol. And it's that type of setup that just builds people. No wonder you have a recidivism rate off the chart with rules like that. Thanks again. Good show.
Thank you very much for calling in. And for anybody else who is interested in calling here in Anchorage, you can call 550-8422. Outside of Anchorage, it's 1-800-478-8255 or talk at alaskapublic.org. And thanks very much for everyone who's tuning in. We're talking about criminal justice reform. So let's jump to some of the issues that our last caller brought up. Tracy, his first one of his concerns was that people with less money aren't being as well defended. You're a public defender.
Well, I like to think the public defender provides the best representation in the state. And we certainly aim to provide zealous and effective representation for all of our clients. That's our number one goal. I think it's the case that it's, you know, difficult potentially for people who don't qualify for the public defender, but don't have a significant income to provide or access maybe the resources that are necessary and potentially to go to trial. And I'm not sure if that's what the caller was getting at. But, you know, I think around the country, you see access to proper defense as a primary issue. I think Alaska is really fortunate to have a statewide public defender system and that provides well, I think, for criminal defendants. But that's not true across the country.
Mm-hmm. And John, please.
I was just going to say that there are some states that struggle with public defender agencies that are not operating at an optimum level. And that can be a notion that's out there, certainly exists in other states. But I have to agree with Tracy that the public defender agency that we have in Alaska is cream of the crop. They are very good at what they do. And I think the folks that are represented by them get excellent representation all across the board.
But there's a gap there. There's the folks who make a little bit too much for public defenders, but not quite enough for the top-notch lawyers.
You know, I don't know how that gap works because from my experience sitting in court, when you hear people ask for the public defender, there's a few questions that are put to them by the court. And by and large, I don't see very many people denied public defenders. So while theoretically there could be a gap and there may be some people who fall into it, my experience in the courtroom is I don't see a lot of that. Now, that's just anecdotal, so I don't know what studies or statistics would tell us. But again, the issue that was brought up was the quality of the representation from the agency. And I'd have to tell you, I think it's pretty good.
Okay. And just to bring it back to justice reform, does SB 91 address public defenders at all? Or are there any changes? None?
There were no changes to the public defender system in SB 91.
Okay. Another concern that the caller brought up was talking about probation conditions. And there's a lot we could talk about with probation. And so risk assessment tools, they're currently in place in the probation process. Is that correct?
I'm not sure how much they're using risk assessment tools in the probation process currently. I think what the caller was suggesting is that there are tools that are out there that could be used. And I would agree that there are a number of tools that are out there. I haven't studied any of those tools, so I can't tell you how well any of them work. The concern that he raised about conditions, I think the example he used was a restriction on the ability to consume alcohol. There's case law in Alaska that says that any condition needs to be reasonably related to the crime. And so that's certainly in a circumstance in which someone commits a crime and alcohol wasn't a part of it, to restrict alcohol consumption would present some issues legally and otherwise there. So.
And I think one thing that the caller's comment made me think of is that there was research considered by the commission in the pretrial context, which suggested that imposing restrictive conditions on low-risk defendants pretrial could actually, again, kind of increase the likelihood of pretrial failure, which essentially means not appearing in court or committing a new offense during the pretrial period. And, you know, similarly on probation, you know, I think it's setting up a list of very restrictive conditions that may not relate to the rehabilitation of the individual or to the crime may potentially, you know, increase the likelihood of failure on probation.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to go to the next caller, and then we should get a little bit more in depth into pretrial and probation. Harry from Anchorage, please welcome to the program.
Hi there. I was the one that originally passed the red stripe law in the legislature, and
is this Harry Crawford?
Yes, it is.
All right, please. Sorry.
Mm-hmm. And originally, when we started this, this was about when my wife got hit by a repeat offender as a hit by a drunk driver and was nearly killed. We wanted to be able to identify the people that had been ordered by the judge to not buy, consume, or enter the premises where alcohol is sold, but there was no way to identify them. What I learned subsequent to that was that about 85% of the people that were in prison or in jail in Alaska had committed their crimes under the influence of alcohol. Now, what the caller didn't say was that this is at the discretion of the judge. If the alcohol had no part in the crime that was committed, they don't have to put the red stripe on their driver's license or state ID, and it doesn't have to be a condition of their parole. But we gave the judge that discretion because a huge majority of the crimes were committed under the influence of alcohol and probably wouldn't have happened if that person hadn't been under the influence of alcohol. Well, the best way to not recidivate is to stay away from alcohol if you're one of those people that have proven that they can't handle the alcohol in the first place.
And so this is a question for my guests in the audience, but also, I suppose, for you, Mr. Crawford. Is it now still discretionary for the judge to decide whether or not I'm seeing nodding for everyone on the radio. It's still up to the judge to decide whether or not a red stripe goes on there.
Right. It is not mandatory. It's at the discretion of the judge. The judge can decide if the alcohol was a factor in committing the crime.
Well, I think actually, if I could just comment, I think maybe we're talking about two different issues. The first is whether the judge has the discretion to impose a no alcohol condition as a condition of probation. And the answer is yes, that is within the judge's discretion, subject to the test that John talked about before. It needs to be reasonably related to the rehabilitation of the individual or to public safety. There's a second question about once that condition is imposed, whether a person needs to get a red stripe, what's colloquially called a red stripe on their license. And SB 91 expands the number of people who are required to get this limitation on their license. So previously, if you were convicted of DUI or refusal and you had a no alcohol condition, you were required to, I think the court was required to seize your license and refer you to the DMV to get a license with the restriction that you were not to consume alcohol. And then there's a further statute that restricts then your purchase of alcohol. SB 91 expanded that sort of limitation to all people who receive a no alcohol condition as a condition of probation or parole.
And so would they have the red stripe on their license or ID forever or just until they're finished with probation and parole?
During the period of supervision only.
Okay, and then they can get a new ID.
Correct.
Does the state help pay for the IDs?
Not to my knowledge, no.
The individual has to pay for the ID. It's $50 charged to them.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks very much for your call. I appreciate any other comments on this issue?
Well, we actually expanded the law in 2010 to other crimes such as domestic violence committed under the influence of alcohol or assault under the influence of alcohol, robbery. Those things were included in 2010, but it was still at the discretion of the judge. What the addition in SB 91, it just added like five words that said, or any other crime. I don't know exactly what that did because I was not a part of the legislature at that time. What our intention was when we did it in 2007 and 2010 was to make sure that if a person committed a crime under the influence of alcohol, the judge had the ability to put that restriction there and a way to identify them.
Okay. Well, thank you for your call. If anybody else would like to chime in, you can call it 550-8422 or 1-800-478-8255. We've been touching on a lot on probation and parole and conditions of release. So I'd like to kind of delve into what SB 91 says about that, which could take us hours to discuss. One of the things that jumped out at me is that if a person has a technical violation of parole, which I'd love for one of you to explain to the general population, a new system limits how long that person can have to go back to jail or to prison. So why do we have a system like that in place that limits how long someone might be sent back?
Well, one of the important things to keep in mind when you talk about conditions of release and probation and parole is conditions of release tends to be pretrial. And so right now we're going to talk about probation and parole, which is after the person's convicted and put on probation and parole. So two completely different subjects.
Sorry, I didn't mean for that.
No, that's yeah. Okay. I just want to make sure that we keep those two things separate. You're correct that for probation and for parole, which again are two different concepts, that for both of them, they are both post-conviction. They are when someone has been sentenced. Parole is if you're being released from jail. Probation could be released from jail, may not be released from jail. But either way, there are conditions imposed upon them. And then you have what are called technical violations. And this was actually one of the things the commission and the legislature debated is what's the definition of a technical violation. I would have to go back and pull the exact section of the statute because they defined it. But technical violations were supposed to be the sort of things where it wasn't a new crime. Now, I think they carved out a few other things, and I hope Tracy's getting ready to pull it up for me so she can read it. But that was the general concept. If it wasn't a new crime, it was considered to be more of a technical violation. And I think what folks were trying to aim at are things like failure to report to your probation officer, consumption of alcohol if there was a no alcohol restriction, that you had consumed alcohol. That's not a new crime. Certainly needed some sort of intervention, but didn't need to be a lengthy intervention, if you will, in being sent back to prison. One of the things the commission looked at is for someone who has been found guilty, essentially, of committing a violation of probation, then what do courts do to sanction that person? And some of this research suggested that folks for those first, second, and third violations were being sent to jail for lengthy periods of time. And as a result, the concern was, is that necessarily the right way to do it? There's a concept in probation or parole that instead of having a lengthy period of time imposed after a lengthy period of time to determine the violation, that the better method of doing it is to try and have one single incident as opposed to lots of violations build up, one single incident, quickly dealt with, quickly adjudicated, and then to have a sanction imposed, again, quickly, but to make it proportional to just that one violation. Whereas in the past, what had happened is folks would commit a violation and the probation officer might say, okay, you really shouldn't have done that, but I'm going to give you another chance and, you know, don't mess up again. The person would go out, have another violation. These would build over time and the probation officer would, again, to the point where they said, you know, I've tried to give you multiple chances and it hasn't worked. So now they bring it all together and it's all presented in court all at the same time. And the concept was that wasn't the best way to go about it. We needed to do short incremental ones. And the concept, at least as it was presented in some of the studies, is that short periods of time for probation sanctions were the right way to go. The 3, 5, and 10 we have are actually the shortest in the country now.
All right. And part of that is because shorter times don't disrupt your life as much and don't disrupt your job and your home life and whatnot.
That's the theory.
All right. We are going to take a quick break before jumping back in and talking to another caller. You're listening to Talk of Alaska on Alaska Public Media.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from Alaska Pipeline Service Company, sustaining Alaska's pipeline and its operations today and into the future.
Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line reminds you that 88% of Alaskans don't allow smoking in their home. A smoke-free environment helps prepare kids for a healthier life and a future free from tobacco. And it makes good economic sense. Secondhand smoke damages property, decreasing its value. Exposure to its toxins leads to disease and increased medical costs. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line.
Welcome back. You're listening to Talk of Alaska on APRM, and today we are discussing SB 91 and criminal justice reform here in Alaska. My guests are John Skidmore with the Department of Law and Tracy Wallenberg with the Public Defender's Office. And we have a call right now, Grant from Up in Barrow. Grant, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning.
When I was younger, I was battling alcoholism and a bad lifestyle, bad choices. Ended up going to prison, and I thought, oh, prison has made me a real man. I fucking went through all the BS, and then I got back out, and then I still made the bad choices, the bad values. And then I ended up going back in, and I had to do another long 4-year term. And that, this time I tried to open my eyes. You can play a game and say yes to the programs, or you can try to absorb information. And it's just a lifestyle that I want to live in, you know. And you have to make the choices of what you want. And I wasn't. It's a terrible lifestyle in prison. It can be very cruel and very mean. It's not a very good way to live. When I got back out, I tried to open my eyes and say, hey, I'm alcoholic. I need to try to get a handle on myself and my values. But I had a good support system. The PO I had, Mrs. Tilcap, she gave me... I'd stumble every once in a while, and she would say, hey, do you want to go back to prison? You know, if you don't straighten up, that's exactly where you're going to go. And I got a little bit older, and my values became better, and it's just, I had to learn, I had to do a lot of growing up emotionally. I've been out for quite a while now, probably a decade now, and it's a much better way of life. The criticism of people coming in, the revolving door, it's a tough lifestyle.
And what I hear you saying is that what you really learned was that in coming, like you learned that you needed to change. You learned that you needed a support system on the outside. And
well, the difference people understanding and not just passing judge saying, hey, okay, here, I can help you out.
And so I'm going to turn your comments around and turn them into a question for our guests. A lot of what he's saying is that he needed support. Are there ways that SB 91 can support people who are leaving prison, just like the Grant found his own support? Are there ways that SB 91 will put those systems into place for most people who are leaving?
I can comment in a couple of ways. I mean, one of the main purposes of SB 91 is to reinvest the funds that are saved from changing our approach to criminal justice into community-based treatment and reentry resources, and the type of support systems that I think people who are in our caller's position can really benefit from when they return to the community. Our caller was very fortunate that it sounded like he already had people in his life that provided that support for him, but not everybody has that. And so the hope is that funds that are saved as a result of the policies of SB 91 will be reinvested in treatment and reentry resources. And the legislature supplemented the reinvestment of those savings by establishing the Recidivism Reduction Fund, which is going to be 50% of the taxes collected on the sale of marijuana. And that's going to go further to recidivism reduction programs. The other thing I wanted to mention is that as part of the training for the new probation and parole changes in SB 91, which are going into effect January 1st of next year, field officers are being trained on effective intervention and graduated sanctions, so that there's a more uniform approach to both negative behavior and positive behavior by probationers on supervision.
The other thing that SB 91 does is it asks the Department of Corrections to ensure that there is a treatment or a release plan in place, which should be looking for some of those components of providing that type of support. And we know that one of the challenges we face in Alaska is that we don't have as many of the support programs out there, which is what Tracy was referring to in trying to get the reinvestment to create those types of programs to help support people.
All right. Thank you very much for your call, Grant, and I hope that your story can be an inspiration for others. We now also have on the line Gerard from Anchorage. Please welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks. I'm glad to be able to be on here and listening to your guys' conversation about the super important issue of criminal justice reform in Alaska.
Thanks. What are your comments or questions?
You know, I just wanted to, I guess, kind of give a shout out to just, I guess, a consideration of, you know, we're hearing a lot of discussion about kind of the conviction side of it, maybe the trial side of it, the judge side of it. But, you know, anytime we go as a community and we look at criminal justice reform, I think that's, you know, I want to, I guess, point out the idea that there are a lot of implications in SB 91 at the full spectrum, to include the law enforcement, you know, street level, all the way up through, you know, judges and, you know, we've talked about probation, parole, how the public defender's office, you know, the state attorneys, the municipal prosecutors. It's really a really big ship, if you will, that we're trying to change course and direction on. And so I don't know, I tend to look at some of our experiences, myself as an employee with the Anchorage Police Department and representing the line level officers who are out trying to implement some of the changes. I've certainly found some difficulty with it, some challenges, and I guess I just wanted to throw in that perspective to say we need to be thinking about how it impacts the everyday work of the officers out doing the work on the street.
Thank you very much. I see a lot of nodding in here. John.
So I really appreciate Gerard Aslan's comments. Those are right on point. And as we mentioned earlier, that anytime you make reforms of this magnitude in a system like this, you have to monitor it. You have to see how things are working. We certainly are aware of concerns that have been expressed by several folks in law enforcement. I have folks in my own department that are concerned about how some of this works. And all I can tell you at this point is that the changes have just been implemented. I don't think there's been enough time since these changes have been implemented to really tell you exactly how they're working yet. But it is something that we're paying attention to and monitoring, and I expect the legislature will even look at some of those things this year. I imagine there will be bills that are introduced that try to amend small portions. I think some people refer to it as a tweak in the bill, to see if there aren't minor adjustments that can be made to try to address issues that may have gotten past people or didn't realize that issue existed in the bill because it was just such a large bill when it went through.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's some of the problem we've encountered in trying to change course of direction through such a large bill, that sometimes there are unintended consequences or consequences maybe that weren't contemplated that, we'll just have to continue to work together on. The only other comment I would add, and I heard from I apologize, but the woman there representing the public defender's office, and this, the idea that there is a hope or a wish that savings from, from the reform will in fact be reinvested towards recidivism reduction efforts. And, you know, from our perspective, from those of us tasked with kind of the day-to-day trying to keep our community safe, and what we see is people who are engaging in criminal activity, oftentimes as a result of whether it be some substance abuse issue, whether that's alcohol or drugs, or maybe it's more of a psychological issue or things going on that are actually influencing and leading to the criminal behavior, that an extremely important component of this is actual legitimate reinvestment of the savings into recidivism reduction. And whether that's treatment, whether that's job training, whether that's education, that's going to be so, so important. And, you know, I have a lot of worry that as we're facing the budget crunch that we are here in the state of Alaska, legitimate budget issues, that our legislators take very seriously the idea that if we're projected savings, and my recollection was something like $300 million on SB 91, that it is an actual legitimate reinvestment into reducing the criminal activity on the part of these folks, not just letting them out sooner, which is a pretty common belief or worry about the structure right now.
So I think just picking up on what John said, the commission's term was extended to 2021, and they've been specifically tasked with monitoring and collecting data on the implementation of the SB 91 reforms. And the other thing they've been tasked with doing, getting to the point by Gerard Aslan, is how savings should be reinvested. And they are tasked with making recommendations to the legislature on that. Both of those items will continue to be monitored by the commission.
All right. And we are going to take a quick break, and then we'll come back and get to some more emails and calls. You're listening to Talk of Alaska.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to having conversations that help businesses and individuals succeed financially, because an open dialogue can open doors. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment. On the web at arcticwirerope.com. And by
GCI, keeping Alaskans connected to live the life they choose. GCI is an Alaska-born and raised telecommunications company and a proud supporter of Alaska Public Media.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. Today we're talking about criminal justice reform. We have an email here from Tom in Fairbanks. He says, does the new law address pretrial bail and third-party custodian requirements? Nationally, it's said they've contributed to the return of debtors to prison.
The answer is yes.
That is a big component of the bill.
The pretrial release is not scheduled to be implemented until January 1st of 2018.
It's a long time.
It is. And the reason that there's time built in there is we talked about developing the risk assessment tool. That's part of what needs to be done. Alaska historically relied on third-party custodians, which is a, I don't know if I want to call it unique to Alaska, but I'm not familiar with it in too many other states at the moment.
Can you just explain what a third-party custodian is, what that requires?
Sure. So the state of Alaska in our statutes actually says that when someone is arrested for an offense and they want to get bailed out, sometimes you can have monetary bail that you have to post, and if you violate conditions, then something can happen to that money. One of the other things that Alaska did is it created something called a third-party custodian, which is a citizen of Alaska who comes into the court and says, I am willing to watch this defendant. I will be the eyes and the ears of the court, of law enforcement, and I will make sure that this person complies with their conditions. And if they don't comply with their conditions, then I am making a promise that I will report that to law enforcement so that this person, law enforcement, can come in and take the appropriate action to correct that.
And so that third-party custodian is with the suspect? is with the person at all times?
Well, there are different levels of third-party custodians. Sometimes they have what's called 24-hour sight and sound, which means you have to be within sight or sound of the person 24 hours a day. Sometimes it's a third-party custodian that they're going to live with this person, but they don't have to be with them 24 hours a day. Sometimes there are multiple third-party custodians so that you can kind of trade the person off, kind of like babysitting. And so there's different levels, and the level that is imposed, those different levels aren't found in statute. Those different concepts are things that the courts have adopted and have evolved in the judicial system over time. But what the email's talking about is that by requiring a particular third party, someone that the court approves of, or by requiring the bail, that what that can result in is that people end up sitting in jail because they couldn't find that third party. They couldn't post that bail, and this is a person that doesn't necessarily need to be in jail and therefore should be released. And so what SB 91 has done is two things. One, it's created the risk assessment tool, or the requirement for the risk assessment tool to be created. And second, it's creating a new division within the Department of Corrections called Pretrial Services. Didn't previously exist. And the idea is that this unit will not only be conducting those risk assessments and providing them to the courts as soon as someone's arrested within 24 hours of that, so it's available for the first court hearing, but they are also then tasked with monitoring folks out in the communities once they've been released so that it doesn't have to be a third party and you don't end up with that individual who maybe is a good candidate to be released, but couldn't find a third party and maybe just didn't have the money to post the bail to begin with. And that's the reference, I believe, to the debtors' prisons in the email.
Okay, because there's, in looking at all the different resources that try to lay out what SB 91 does, there's this great chart that says, like, if for certain types of offenses, people have to be released on their own reconnaissance, I can't say that word, and there's others who have to have certain types of bail. Is the whole idea behind that so that people like who can't afford secured bonds aren't stuck there waiting?
So the chart, that there are two different charts, and I'm not sure which chart you're referring to. There's one chart that talks about the recommendations that the pretrial services officers have to make. And there are certain categories in which they are required to make a recommendation for being released OR. And then there's another chart that talks about the judicial discretion in terms of the decision that's actually made of when somebody can be released. And there are certain segments of the chart, certain types of crimes, and a risk level of the offender. So think of it as sort of your X and your Y axis mm-hmm. that have to meet to the same place on that chart. And if they are both low risk and a certain type of offense, they're supposed to be released without any bail, without any other supervision. But if they are a higher risk or a higher level of offense, then the court has discretion about how much bail should it be imposing, whether or not pretrial services should be monitoring them, et cetera. And the chart is obviously a graduated one that the more serious the offense or the greater the risk, the more conditions there should mm-hmm. be for the person to be released.
The research relied on by the commission showed that unsecured bail is often as effective as secured bail across similar risk levels, but that secured bail, like we've been talking about, has kept people incarcerated. And so the hope with SB 91 is that there's that move from a sort of money-based system in which whether someone is detained is often based on whether or not they can afford bail to a risk-based system, which research shows these risk assessments can accurately predict the risk of pretrial failure. And so the charts that John are talking about basically eliminate the use of secured money bail for many nonviolent misdemeanor and Class C felonies and sort of strengthen the presumption that you won't get released on secured bail if you're sort of in a middle category of people. And then for higher risk individuals who are charged with really serious crimes, then the judge can impose money bail without having to meet that higher evidentiary burden. The hope is that this will lead to a situation where people aren't being inadvertently incarcerated pretrial because they can't afford their bail.
And this is all going into effect January 2018?
Correct.
Okay. We have another caller on the line. Who prefers to remain anonymous? Please welcome to the program.
Yeah, I kind of believe the system is just kind of designed to fail. I mean, as far as the drug addicts and alcoholics go, I think they need to be able to determine and realize that it's a sickness, and they're not a criminal, you know, for being sick.
Mm-hmm.
And they just kind of need to wake up, and society and people, Europeans are doing it, and they're realizing it. You know, they can't treat them as criminals. You have to help these people, and they don't want help at the beginning, so they're going to fall. They're going to fail. It's designed to fail, the system. The system needs to be a stair-step deal where people get help, and they need to look away from the negativity of the failure, and they need to look into, you know, becoming good again and great again, like the last caller that realized what was going wrong with his life.
And so
that's all I'm saying.
The system needs to be to provide a safety net for people who are experiencing addiction, experiencing mental illness.
Right, mental illness, you know, whatever it is, you know, if they're doing heroin or meth or alcohol or whatever they're doing, they need to get past that part of their life and move on and become better, get out of the sickness. It's just a cycle, and it's just, you know, people want to make money off of it.
And so, Tracy, correct me if I'm wrong, but a lot of parts of SB 91 are really focused on that, on making the changes so it is a safety net that helps people handle their addictions or get mental health treatment.
Yeah, again, I think the idea behind SB 91 and other sort of justice reforms around the country is to focus prison beds on the most serious offenses, or the violent and serious offenses, and reinvest savings into these sorts of treatment that the caller is talking about, so that the Department of Corrections doesn't become or doesn't remain the default treatment provider in the state, particularly what we know now about the impact of prison on low-risk offenders.
And now we have a call from Gregory in St. Paul Island. Welcome to the program.
Good morning. Good morning.
Good morning.
Yes, I'm Greg Craig, Senior. I have my comments, but I was listening to the guy that made that last comment, and I do believe, and I agree with him, the crimes committed and the alcohol and drugs. There was a case I know had an adverse effect on the brain, and they found he had a frontal lobe brain dysfunction. But the courts and the judge, you know, sometimes when they have trials, which I attended one, they didn't take that into consideration. And that has an effect on sentencing, too. And some of the remarks the judges make, like, we'll teach St. Paul Island a lesson, I think that's uncalled for. So more research has to be done on who are medically affected by alcohol and drugs.
Gregory, thank you so much for your comments, and thank you to everyone who called in. That's all we have time for today. This is Talk of Alaska. We've had John Skidmore and Tracy Wallenberg talking about criminal justice reform. Thanks for listening.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. And by Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight, from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. It's a fact, over half of Alaska Native adults don't use tobacco. For more resources on building a healthy life, visit anthc.org/weare. This message is sponsored by ANTHC, a nonprofit organization. The Older Persons Action Group is the publisher of the monthly Senior Voice newspaper and the 2016 directory for older Alaskans. To order the directory or to learn more, go to seniorvoicealaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG. This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.